Then to the second case, Flying J Incorporated versus City of New Haven. Good morning. Mr. Toth?
Yes, sir.
You're up.
Disorganized there.
Well, and we moved up the time, too, so I appreciate everyone accommodating the court.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Justin Toth. I represent the plaintiff and appellant, Flying J, Inc., in this matter. Your Honor, if it's permissible with the court, I would like to divide my time this morning with 12 minutes for my initial presentation and then 3 minutes for my rebuttal. That's a slight modification from what I originally proposed, if that's acceptable to the court.
It is.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor, I'd like to divide my presentation this morning into three separate categories. First, I'd like to discuss the facts in Flying J's original amended complaint. Second, I'd like to discuss the district court's misapplication of the Louth opinion to Flying J's complaint. And third, I'd like to discuss this court's decision in the Roblewski opinion, which provides the correct paradigm or prism with which to view this case. I want to begin, Your Honor, by emphasizing that contrary to the defendant's assertion, the defendant's assertions in this case, this is not a garden variety zoning dispute. And as the facts that I'm going to describe to you will illustrate, this, in fact, is a very different type of case. Specifically, this case begins in 2004 when Flying J purchases a piece of property on the outskirts of New Haven, Indiana, for the purpose of building a travel plaza.
Let me just stop you there for a minute, because you're saying it's not an ordinary zoning case, but what you were seeking relief for is, it really is a form of a declaratory judgment invalidating the ordinance in this case, right?
That is in part the relief we're seeking. We're also seeking monetary damages, Your Honor.
And what are the damages based on?
The damages are based on, because of this ongoing, for lack of a better word, Your Honor, conspiracy to prevent Flying J to develop this property due to the selective scheme in putting together this amended ordinance and the conflicts of interest, which we've now discovered and raised properly before this court, the conflicts of interest of key members of the Planning Commission, the Board of Zoning Appeals, and the City Council, which approved this ordinance, that has delayed Flying J 2.5 years of revenue of developing and utilizing this piece of property.
So, but the bottom line is you would still like to invalidate the ordinance.
Yes, that is that among the rest of the relief we seek, that is correct, Your Honor. In essence, what happened over the court, the facts in this case, and I'm going to focus this morning particularly on the conflicts of interest that arose in this case. So let me address the first conflict that Flying J was not aware of at the time, but begins to give you a flavor of what was going on in Flying J's complaint. In early 2005, after the city had originally denied Flying J's preliminary proposal to build the travel plaza, the Board of Zoning Appeals held a public hearing on April 20th on Flying J's denial and on Flying J's travel plaza. At that hearing, a man by the name of Ronald Steinman spoke in opposition to Flying J's development and in opposition to the travel plaza. What Mr. Steinman was at that time was a member of the New Haven City Council and a member of the very powerful Planning Commission of New Haven. In other words, Mr. Steinman, when you wanted to do something in terms of land use in the city of New Haven, Mr. Steinman was a man you would talk to, and Mr. Steinman's words carried weight. Comes as no surprise that the BZA, after hearing Mr. Steinman speak about 2 weeks after that public hearing, ruled against Flying J. At the time, Your Honor, and this goes back to this notion of garden variety zoning dispute, Flying J didn't think much of that and simply proceeded on to circuit court to appeal it there. What Flying J did not know at that time and did not discover until about 6 months ago was that Mr. Steinman is Flying J's next-door neighbor. Mr. Steinman operates a business called AAA Auction. It's his personal livelihood, right next to where Flying J was going to build this travel center. In other words, Mr. Steinman and Flying J are neighbors. They share a property boundary. Mr. Steinman did not want
was
to.
His,
yes, sir.
Was his ownership of this property concealed, or was it as a matter of record?
Your Honor, it was not disclosed to us during
No. I want to know, was it matter of record? Could one go look at the record, see who lived next door?
You can look the records, and we did that, sir. We discovered that AAA Auction owned the property. It wasn't his name, but by doing some additional discovery, we figured that out. It was not, I don't believe there was an intent by him to conceal his ownership.
So you say you didn't discover until 6 months ago. You had an opportunity to discover it for 3 years.
That's correct, Your Honor, but we assumed that the city was acting in good faith.
The fact that he lived next door to you would have, or ran business next door to you, wouldn't show lack of good faith. It just shows he's next door to you.
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Steinman took a very active role.
I wouldn't doubt that a bit. That was his business, was taking an active role. You described all the jobs he had. They require active roles. Well, I don't know how it came, got to be a surprise to you to find out this guy next door was the same fella.
Well, the answer, honest in part, is we've never had an opportunity to conduct discovery in this case.
Didn't have an opportunity to look at the record of the property surrounding where you were. When you're asking for a change in zoning, wouldn't you worry about the people who are going to be affected by the zoning, i.e. the people who abut the property you're talking about? Because there's your opposition if you're going to get one.
We were not asking for a change in zoning.
What were you asking for?
We believed the zoning permitted our use, and we asked.
And they didn't.
But ultimately, the Indiana Court of Appeals said it did.
Yeah. So you were right in that lag, but you then just proceeded on a theory that you didn't care who was next door.
I wouldn't say that we didn't care, Your Honor. We just didn't believe that we needed to conduct discovery on each of the members.
We're talking about discovery. We're talking about whether or not, if you are worrying about your use of a particular piece of property, you applied for a permit to build something. People who would object to that permit would be the people adjoining. That's true whether you're building a house, a gas station, or whatever you're building, right?
Yes, sir.
You'd like to know who lived next door. Who's going to be your potential objector?
Yes, sir.
And you didn't.
In this case, with respect to Mr. Steinman, Your Honor, you're correct. We did not discover that he owned AAA Auction prior to that. I will say, however, sir, if I may, we did discover, because once we realized that there apparently were city members who were willing to participate in this with conflicts of interest, we did discover that a member of the Board of Zoning Appeals also owned or operated a business directly across the street from us, a member named Mickey Hill. We asked her, and when she considered applying the amended ordinance to Flying J, to recuse herself from that process since it would directly impact her business to have a large-scale truck stop operating across the street. She refused to do so and then took a lead role in advocating against, and a very active role in the hearing, advocating against Flying J's development of the property and in applying the amended ordinance to Flying J. So that's one, Your Honor, we caught, we spotted, and we asked them to recuse themselves, and they still wouldn't.
Well, that ordinance that was passed prohibited anybody from building a large travel center, right? And why isn't that a legitimate state interest? I understand your argument in terms of the motivation of some of the people who voted on it. But why couldn't it still be a legitimate state interest, notwithstanding their personal stake?
I think it's possible, Your Honor. I think it's absolutely possible, Your Honor, that a government can say, we want to regulate the density of certain uses, and we think this type of use might be inappropriate. I don't think we wouldn't dispute that, Your Honor. What we dispute is that what we are deeply troubled by is the fact that this was a covert process of passing this, as we've alleged in the complaint and we've alleged in our briefs, a covert process of passing this amended ordinance, and that two members of two government officials had direct financial interests that were implicated by this. And we think, Your Honor, that then taints the legitimate government interest. In fact, it makes this case look like this court's opinion or the facts similar to this court's opinion in Forsyth versus Village of Sussex from 2000. In that case, Your Honor, the mayor of the city had a property line that abutted the property, the plaintiff appellant in that case, who is a developer, his property abutted the developer's property. And the mayor said, in order for me to agree to your development plan, you have to deed to me a piece of property essentially for $1,500, far below its market value. And the plaintiffs ultimately sued the mayor and the city.
Was there a demand for you to give something to these people in this case, in the present case?
No, sir, Your Honor.
So you're describing a distinction which involves a shakedown. Well, you'd be tantamount to blackmail, a shakedown. It's probably a criminal offense just to start with. But what you're describing here is somebody who has an obvious interest in in not allowing the zoning, or not allowing the permit to happen. It was obvious to you.
It was obvious that, well, we believe there are two people.
Not a conspiracy. It's right out where you can see it.
Well, the conspiracy, Your Honor, wasn't out where we could see it. And the only time it came forward, when we confronted them with it, and we told the city officials we thought it was inappropriate because their financial interests were implicated, personal financial interests, the only one we were able to confront refused to recuse herself. Mm-hmm. So, Your Honor, I do understand your distinction, Your Honor, that this is not, no one was extracting a specific value from us, but it doesn't change the fact that these were governmental officials involved in the critical governmental agencies that were involved in approving this process and passing this amended ordinance, whose personal financial interests were at stake in making these decisions.
Perhaps I missed it, but can you tell me how many members of there were of the New Haven Common Council? Because that was one entity involved, and how many for the New Haven BZA?
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I can't tell you exactly how many members were on the New Haven Common Council.
Because, you know, your argument is, you know, we have two individuals who were leading the charge, but it is helpful to know how many were those entities.
Your Honor, off the top of my head, I don't want to get that wrong. I don't know the precise number as I stand here before the court. I'd be happy to submit that to the court in the form of a letter or a supplemental brief.
Maybe your opponent knows.
Nathan, if we can ask Mr. Nybarger.
Well, Ms. Feld, when you became aware of the one individual because you moved for the recusal,
yes, sir.
Did you make any inquiry of other Planning Commission members or council whether they had any property that might arguably be impacted by your application?
Your Honor, we learned that the answer to your question is no. We learned about Mickey Hill. This is late 2007. Actually, this is after the motion to dismiss had been filed and the district court had ruled. Oh, I'm sorry. This is late 2007. This is after the complaint had been filed, and I believe the motion to dismiss had been filed also at that time.
Right.
We, at that point, were not able to conduct any further discovery. We couldn't find, based on our view of the property records at that time, we didn't find any additional members of the city council who owned adjacent properties or businesses.
But you made that inquiry, you say?
Yes, sir. So ultimately, Your Honor, this leaves the district court in a very odd, in viewing our complaint, in a very odd position. Because what the district court ultimately does is it takes the Louth opinion, which is a summary judgment case and a summary judgment opinion, and if you read the district court's opinion, what it does is it goes into an in-depth discussion of the rational basis for the city's motives. Your Honors, this is a motive.
You're into your rebuttal. I just thought I'd tell you.
Oh, in that case, Your Honor, I will stop at this point, and I will save the rest for rebuttal.
You might feel comforted in the fact that, you know, we've all read all the briefs.
Yes, sir.
All right. Mr. Nybarger?
I gather from your silence you don't know how many members of the various organizations that passed in this are, how many members there are.
You're correct, Your Honor. I do not know off the top of my head. I do know it is more than one on each. May it please
it help. Seems that could be helpful and useful information for us because when he's making the argument that each individual had some undue influence or some motivation, that might be helpful to know.
I agree with Your Honor. It may be helpful to know, but I don't think it's dispositive. I think that, as we cited on page 23 of the city's brief, there's nothing more common in zoning disputes, especially in small towns, for selfish opposition to zoning. That's the Coniston case. Nothing more common in zoning disputes than selfish opposition. The Constitution does not forbid the government to yield to such opposition.
What's the size of New Haven?
Your Honor, I don't know off the top of my head. The population is a small town outside or of Fort Wayne.
Have you ever been there?
I have been there, Your Honor. I have.
Only to pick up your check or?
No, Your Honor. I've traveled through New Haven on several. I just don't know the population off the top of my head.
How many stoplights?
I'm sorry?
You said you traveled through. I just wonder if you know how many stoplights. Sometimes that gives you an indication.
I don't know the number of stoplights. More than one.
You can see Judge Flom came from a small town.
So did I.
I myself was born in Chicago, which makes it very difficult for you to discuss small town, except that I was also state's attorney of DuPage, which has 34 small towns.
Respectfully, Your Honor, if every time that somebody had an interest that could be at stake, and that's the argument here, it could be turned into a constitutional case, the floodgates of litigation in this court would be very busy. I don't believe that a potential interest, a financial interest, whether it implicates any member of the public, which these people represent, creates a constitutional case, a federal equal protection case.
Well, one of the arguments he's making is that they didn't receive notice of various hearings that were held regarding the amendment to the ordinance. Is there any rule that requires notice of hearings?
Well, let's talk about that on two levels. The federal cases are very clear that in the zoning context and in a legislative context, a person is not entitled to any notice or an opportunity to be heard whatsoever. On the state level, I'm not aware of any law that was violated. None was alleged. Indiana does have a notice requirement, and it's not alleged that it wasn't followed. It's public notice. These were publicly noticed meetings. There were publicly noticed agendas. These were public hearings. And that is what required of Indiana law, and it was followed. And to the extent that that law was violated, which there's no allegation or inference that it was, but this court has said time and time again that violation of state law does not create a constitutional violation. It's also important to note in this context, Your Honor, that the city's amendment does not affect the types of uses whatsoever. Rather, the city's amendment only affects the size of service stations and accessory uses, and it limits that size to 2 acres. Thus, Flying J, and it's important to know, can have its travel plaza with its proposed uses. It just can't have it as large as it desires. It's also important to note, Your Honor, as cited on page 13 of our brief, that had Flying J simply filed an application for site development plan or approval, whatever, prior to the enactment of the amended ordinance, we wouldn't be here today. Indiana state law is clear. If you file an application, at the time you file that application, the local zoning ordinances and the zoning laws in place at the time you file your application govern the grant and denial of that application and related filings for a period of 3 years. Notwithstanding the fact that Flying J did not file its application, we're here today on an alleged federal equal protection claim. And it is our position that the district court correctly dismissed that claim.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you think it matters that, for purposes of jurisdiction, that in addition to seeking declaratory relief, Flying J is seeking damages, compensation for damages?
Well, I think it's more than that. They're actually asking for an injunction. If you look at their complaint, they're asking to enjoin the application of an ordinance and basically enjoin the zoning authority and join the application of the legislation. I think it's important for ripeness rules that they may be asking for damages, but I don't think necessarily that that's dispositive. We haven't argued as such in the briefs. On jurisdictional issues, I would like to point out one key case that this court should consider. It's the Sprint Spectrum versus City of Carmel case, and I think that that's important for ripeness consideration, Your Honor. In the Sprint case, it was an application of the Williamson ripeness rule. And Sprint had applied for a building permit and received a building permit to put antennas in a building on property for cellular service. It relied on that building permit and began construction. The neighbor, during the construction process, objected to the City of Carmel, and the building commissioner for the City of Carmel then revoked the building permit. Sprint was unhappy with that result. It appealed that result to the BZA. And the BZA held that Sprint's intended use was not a permitted use under the ordinance. Sprint was unhappy with that result, and it repaired to federal court, alleging many violations of the Federal Telecommunications Act. But the important part is that this court said, Sprint, your case is not ripe, because Sprint had not applied for and received the final ruling on a variance. This court held that it is mere speculation until Sprint had received the final ruling on its variance, whether it would have incurred an injury to complain of. And we believe that that rationale is applicable here. Here, there is no evidence in the record of the complaint, number one, that the BZA has taken final action or that there has been a final ruling on the application or enforceability of this ordinance with respect to Flying J. Most importantly, glaringly absent from the record of complaint is any indication that Flying J has sought a variance or received a final ruling on that variance. Thus, like the case in Sprint, it is our position that it's mere speculation until Flying J receives a final ruling on its request for a variance, whether it will incur an injury to complain of. Now, Your Honor, after we've discussed the subject matter jurisdiction issue, I think it is important to discuss this Laos case that was mentioned by Mr. Toth. It's important for a number of reasons, and that Louth recognized that there were multiple standards for class of one cases in the circuit, and it tried to clarify that with one solid standard. And in doing so, and the rational basis test, when no suspect classes are at issue, this court held that governmental action only fails rational basis scrutiny if no sound reason for the action can be hypothesized. It went on and held that animus only comes into play when no rational reason or motive being imaginable for the injurious action. It would be inexplicable unless animus had motivated it. I think that's important. And Flying J understands the import of that holding, and that's why it tries to run away from it. As you heard today, he'll say that the Louth case is a summary judgment case, and therefore it only applies in the summary judgment context when evidence is being weighed. But that's not what the court said in Louth. The Louth court was very clear when it said, quote, since hypothesis is not proof, the test we have articulated today, can often be applied in advance of discovery. The court then cited three cases of dismissal under the Rule 12b6 context. It's also important to note that Louth relied on the 1993 U.S. Supreme Court case of FCC versus Beach for the proposition that a federal court need only be able to rationalize a basis for the action, that is, have a rational basis, hypothesize one. The Beach case recognized that a legislature is not required to articulate any reason whatsoever for the enactment of a statute. It said it is entirely irrelevant, for constitutional purposes anyway, whether the conceived reason for the challenge distinction actually motivated the legislature. In other words, in the words of the Beach Court, quote, legislative choice is not subject to courtroom fact-finding, and it may be based on rational speculation, unsupported by evidence or empirical data, close quote. I think it's quite clear that one can rationalize a number of rational hypothesize a number of rational bases for the size restriction of the amended ordinance. Anyone who's been to a service station, gas station, or travel plaza knows that they implicate traffic concerns, concerns of air, noise, and light pollution. They involve the storage, disposal, and distribution of not only combustible but toxic substances, therefore implicating the public health, safety, and welfare. I think it's beyond dispute that these implicate rational and legitimate concerns for the government. We also believe, Your Honor, that the ProEco decision, ProEco versus the Board of Commissioners, relied upon by the district court is dispositive of this case. In ProEco, the Jay County Board of Commissioners implemented an ordinance creating a moratorium on the development of landfills. At the time the ordinance was instituted, ProEco was the only one with an eye towards development. ProEco was upset. It ran to federal court claiming equal protection grounds, and this court rejected the equal protection claim because it noted that the ordinance was generally applicable to all those who wished to develop a landfill, and because no other landfill developers were granted waivers and ProEco was not. The same is true here. You will hear Flying J argue that the amended ordinance only applies to it, but the amended ordinance on its face is generally applicable. The size restriction language applies to any, quote, service station, close quote, whether it's Flying J's, Travel Center of America's, Love Travel Stops, or any other of the multitude of developers who wish to develop a service station, gas station, or travel plaza within the city's zoning authority. Similarly, Flying J cannot and has not alleged that anyone has received a waiver from the enforcement. Importantly, no one would have received a waiver because the amended ordinance was not in effect in relation to the pre-existing service stations of which it claims received waivers. And according to the allegations in its own complaint, the pre-existing service stations are all smaller than 2 acres. Thus, they wouldn't need a waiver. Flying J can't show any waivers. Thus, Your Honor, we believe that the district court was correct in dismissing the claim. We also believe that the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction. The claim was not ripe. We request that this court affirm the dismissal of the complaint and of the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Neilberger. Mr. Toth.
I'd like to address a couple of points made by Mr. Neilberger. First, Your Honor, I think it's important to keep the procedural position of this case in context. This case has been decided on a motion to dismiss. There has been no factual evidence presented in this case. The defendants in this case have not filed an answer, there are no affidavits, and there is no discovery. This case was to be decided by the district court solely on the pleading, solely on the facts alleged in Flying J's complaint. Rule 12b6 instructs us that Flying J is entitled, that the court is required to take those pleadings as true, and is also required to take the reasonable inferences from those facts as true. When you add together the conflicts of interest of two significant members of the Board of Zoning Appeals, the Planning Commission, and the City Council, along with the secretive process by which they passed this amended ordinance and applied it only to Flying J. Flying J is the only entity to whom this would currently apply, and the city is well aware of that. That is, when you put all those inferences together, that brings this case into very similar to the Forseth case, where the means used by city officials to protect themselves are not rationally related to a governmental end. In other words, what's going on here is not legislation for the benefit of the citizens of New Haven. It's legislation to prevent a use that is not conducive to the economic interests of Ron Steinman.
Well, Mr. Roth, is there any suggestion that New Haven had permitted an entity similar in size in the area?
No, Your Honor.
So it isn't targeted toward your size, at least.
We're not sure why. We know it's targeted at us and our development of the property as a truck stop. We know that for certain. And we know that in part because of quotes made by Brian Yeo, the planning administrator, in the local paper, where he said he was instructed by zoning board officials to oppose Flying J's development of that piece of property with a travel plaza at all costs, essentially. And they have done precisely that. So it's very clear that this is directed at Flying J. It's also very clear the reason, or at least the reasonable inference, is it's directed at Flying J because there are city officials who don't want this piece of property developed this way because they don't want a 24-hour, 17-acre truck stop operating right next to their properties. Well, that may be good for those city officials, but that's not necessarily good for the citizens of New Haven. And, in fact, at some of the latter meetings, city council meetings, when we're approving this statute, no one spoke out against Flying J, and no one spoke against the project. So this is a case where Flying J's equal protection rights have been denied by city officials who are misusing their government authority essentially to protect their own interests.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.